All right, we did have one question that resulted from last week, so I'll handle that briefly. Last week we studied Daniel chapter 3. We went through Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and so forth, and the statue, the golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar had set up as a distortion of the truth of the statue revealed in Daniel chapter 2. When he himself took those four kingdoms and distorted them all into one kingdom, and he himself became all that is and demanded the worship. The state always makes itself ultimate. The question is this: I've often wondered why Daniel's not mentioned in chapter 3, but only Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Why isn't Daniel there? Well, this relates to the issue of civil disobedience. Since Daniel's three friends committed civil disobedience, we would expect to find Daniel committing civil disobedience as well, but we don't. And the question is, why not? Well, some people say maybe he was sick. Other people say maybe he was out of town on government business. And still others say that Daniel wouldn't be required to worship at the ceremony because his loyalty was unquestioned since he served in the royal court. Now, we're not told in the text directly why he's not involved. But I think probably the best answer is that Daniel served in the royal court and his loyalty was basically unquestioned. In ancient, one of the interesting things, if you maybe journey into some Middle Eastern places, you'll see that not only in ancient days, but in modern days, kings who rule from a particular palace or so forth, in more of the dictator type systems of government, will put up images of themselves in the farther reaches of their kingdom where they're not. And this is to remind the people that are in those districts that, in fact, I do rule here despite my absence. And you can see this kind of thing. We saw this kind of thing in Jordan, where the King Prince Abdullah had his picture everywhere. It was like a billboard. Like every other billboard was King Prince Abdullah. You're like, I'm tired of seeing this guy large in the sky. But the point was there to remind everybody that I rule. And it may be that since Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego rule in more distant provinces from the royal court, that indeed, that is why they are involved in chapter 3 and Daniel is not. He served in the royal court directly with Nebuchadnezzar. But in any case, we're not told, we're not told directly. But we can look forward as we get further revelation, the book of Revelation, chapter 13, and recall that image worship looks forward to Antichrist's requirement of image worship. And so Revelation 13 is another startling reminder that the Gentile power structures that are described in Daniel with his three friends and so forth are still with us, and the same attempts are being made to make the state God incarnate. All right, last time we started working with the repercussions of the exile. The first one we looked at was that there's the rise of a new kind of literature, apocalyptic literature. This is given when there's a era of long silence coming. God is shutting down His verbal revelation to man, and so apocalyptic literature reveals God's long-term plans. Normally in these books, the big events of history that are coming are revealed, and this gives man hope. That's why the end of the Old Testament sees the rise of apocalyptic in three books: Daniel, Ezekiel, and Zechariah. That's why the New Testament ends with the book of Revelation. So that's one of the repercussions of the exile. The second repercussion of the exile was the rise, this is amazing, the rise of seven different world religions within 50 years. Look at this quote from Robert Brown's book, Religion, Origin, and Ideas. In the 6th century B.C., there was a tidal wave of revolt against the priestcraft of the ancient world. This wave shattered the power of the old religions, though their cults continued to exist as backwaters for centuries. Seven world religions appeared within 50 years of each other, and all continue to this day. Now, here they are. The dates on this slide, look at those dates. Okay, just scan from top to bottom. And think about the period of the exile. A remarkable fact. Okay, I've never seen ever a historian deal with this adequately. The exile occurred in 586 down to 516 for the southern kingdom. And even after that, the partial restoration, there still remained a lot of Jews in dispersion. What happened in 586 B.C.? Well, we've already said that the Shekinah glory departed from the temple. We traced it in Ezekiel 8 and 10. So you have the departure of the glory. The Jews were dispersed out into the surrounding nations. With them, they take the Torah. Okay, and the Torah testifies to the Abrahamic covenant that there is a plan for history. There is a purpose for history. History has a direction. It has a goal. The Torah also carries the testimony of the Mosaic covenant, that there is such a thing as law and ethics, that there is such a thing as responsibility, that there is truth. The Torah gives birth in the later writings of the Hebrews to the wisdom literature of the golden era of Solomon, the poetry, the Psalms, the Proverbs, the idea that there was an underlying unity to all of life. These areas, when the Jews, these ideas must have gone out with the Jewish people as they went into these other nations at the exile. They must have spread all over the Middle East. Wherever the Jews went, these ideas from the Word of God went. Now, if you look at the dates, the first guy out, it's important to see who it is in the sequence of dates, Zoroaster. We don't hear much about Zoroastrianism, but it's a dualism, typical, good and evil. Now, look at his date, 600 down to 583 B.C. Didn't last long. Founded the religion of Persia. On our statue that Daniel revealed, in Daniel 2, which kingdom is Persia? First, second, third, or fourth? He's the second part of that statue. So Daniel, the second kingdom that he ruled in Babylon, but what's the second kingdom he ruled in? He ruled in Persia. What kind of circles did Daniel circulate in, socially speaking? Was he down the lower class or was with the cultural elite, the high upper ruling class? Did Zoroaster ever run across Daniel? I don't know. Who later, though, influences Persia? We mentioned her last week, Esther. Did Esther bring biblical ideas into that culture? You bet she did. Okay, Persia expanded all the way over to the east into India. Could the biblical ideas have spread that far into the east? Yes, they could have. They probably did. In India, Mahavira Vardhamana, 599 to 527 B.C. started Jainism. Gautama, 560 to 480 B.C. introduced Buddhism. Hindu reformers began Vedanta Monism, okay, with the Upanishads, same period. I don't have direct dates. The same period. In China, Lao Tzu, 604 to 517 B.C., founded Taoism. And Confucius, 551 to 479 B.C., pioneered Confucianism. You'll always hear it, inevitably, when you talk to unbelievers. Well, there are all these religions, and therefore nobody can know which one is right. What I'm trying to point out is that all these world religions have biblical origins. That ultimately the distortions of biblical thought permeating these regions. Why else do you have this correspondence with the exile, with the Jews going out? What else explains the rise of seven world religions in a single century, when you see that nowhere else in the history of the world? Let's go back briefly. Okay, this idea that I'm positing here, that the biblical truth was taken into these regions and distorted into these other forms, into these other religions, is not a new idea. I've already covered this with you once before. So let's go back. We said earlier in our class, when Noah's family got off the boat, they all had the Noahic Bible. Every family on earth stepped off of that boat with Genesis 1 through 9. So they all knew of the God of creation. They all knew about the fall. They all knew about the judgment, salvation of the flood, one way of salvation and so forth. All that was common knowledge to all men who got off that boat and all families that therefore spurred forth from those people. But very rapidly it was distorted, we said. It was twisted. That's what the pagan mind that is in enmity with God does to truth. It suppresses the truth and it distorts it. And you can trace the two groups of people that were coming out, basically, of the original Noahic family. There was first the group of people that stayed true to the truths of the Noahic Bible. Mainly, we'd say they were represented in the time of Abraham by Melchizedek, the priest of Salem. He was apparently one of the last vestiges of people who held to biblical beliefs, which is why God called Abraham out. God didn't call Abraham out because he's an arbitrary, unfair God. He did it to salvage truth for the human race. If he didn't call out Abraham, we'd say that the truth would have been so maligned and so distorted and so beyond recognition that no one could have ever been saved. The information just would have been just completely lost. So you have that gracious act of God of calling one man out in the doctrines of election, justification, and faith. So you have that one branch through Melchizedek that was dying out. And he represents the last of the biblical priesthood, and he, so to speak, passes the torch on to Abraham. On the other hand, the other group, the mass majority, were suppressing the truths of Genesis 1 through 9. They were distorting and twisting these truths. And this gave rise to polytheism, the gods and the goddesses, the ancient mythology. Not what you see here. This is a rejection in the 6th century of those prior polytheistic pagan gods and goddesses and so forth. John Pilkey, who we quoted earlier in this class, who studied Genesis 9, 10, and 11 for over 40 years. He was part of an ancient movement called the Euhemerists, who really focused on the Table of Nations and so forth and really were interested in this period. Pilkey wrote his dissertation on it. He sort of resurrected the old Euhemerist movement. He argues that the gods and the goddesses that came out of the flood after that period were faint remembrances of the men who had the powers of longevity. Those people who could live 400, 500, 600 years became in the minds of men like gods. And so, in any case, he says, they were nothing more than these men who could outlive everybody. They could outthink everybody, and who could accomplish tremendous feats. Now those are what ancient pagan man amplified into the gods and goddesses. And this ancient pagan religion began to rule the world. Here's a quote by Mircea Eliade, a famous authority on ancient religions. He argues, "The genuine religions appear after the supreme being has vanished. The richest and most dramatic myths, the most extravagant rituals, gods and goddesses of the most various kinds, all this is found in cultures in which the supreme being is either absent, forgotten, or amalgamated with other divine figures to the point where he is no longer recognizable." Okay, so that's a description of the world after the flood and what happened in men's thoughts. The only clear remaining remnant of this early polytheism that broke out after the flood is Hinduism. Hinduism, which is still with us today, of course, is a combination of the elements of ancient polytheism in its purest expression, with all the priesthood, all the rituals, and of course, through time, it has attracted to it itself certain elements of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Okay, but in the intellectual strands, it has morphed into what's called modern monism. Monism is simply just the idea that all is one, essentially, that there's a unified system, and that all is basically one. We'd say it's a slick form of the continuity of being, an ancient idea. But our point here, in simply just taking it back for a moment into the flood period, is to show that what the human flesh does, the sinful flesh, is it distorts and it perverts the truth. Man left to himself will always distort and suppress and change the truth until it is it's unrecognizable. And so you had this rapid deterioration from Noah and his family in the next 200-300 years, a rapid deterioration away from the truth. And now when we come to the exile, 600 BC, we are seeing kind of a repeated thing here. Another sudden surge forward in the pagan religious thought of man. Seven world religions in a single century. Now, if you look at this seriously, all these religions that people say, you know, well, what about Buddhism and what about Jainism? Well, they all arose within 70 years of one another. All of them arose during the period of the exile, when the Jew was cast out of Israel, and he walked into all these other countries. Now, tell me that's just a coincidence. Tell me there wasn't some sort of influence going on there. Because if you look particularly at these four religions, first two and the last two, Zoroastrianism, Jainism, and then the last two, Confucianism and Judaism, they all share one thing in common. Okay, they're all ethical religions. Confucius was an ethicist. He dealt primarily with ethics. Okay, he wasn't interested in theology at all. He was interested in ethics. He said, Confucius knows nothing about God. It's not even about God. It's just about doing right and wrong and so forth. What is right, what is wrong. Same with Jainism. Okay, so their emphasis was ethics. Even Judaism, okay, the legalistic system that arose in the 6th century BC, Judaism never went back to a thoroughly Old Testament religion. It broke away and never returned from the time of the exile. So Judaism is a movement that eventually winds up in our New Testament being basically identified with the Pharisees, that sect. So we see them in the New Testament, and that began right here in the exile. The other three in the middle, if you look at those names, Buddhism, Vedanta Monism, and Taoism, they all developed the ancient pagan idea of the continuity of being. Yes, sir? Oh, yeah, it's pronounced Taoism, Tao, or what most people call it, Taoism. But it is pronounced Taoism. I don't know why, but it's pronounced that way. It means way or path. And sort of like when we come to the New Testament, and Christianity in the book of Acts is known as the way, the path. And it's called that in the book of Acts, and that's coming from the same source of this word, Taoism, which means way or path. I don't know why it's pronounced Tao other than Tao, but it is. Now, these three all developed the ancient pagan idea of the continuity of being, that all is one, that everything only differs in degree. There's only one level of reality, and they identify God as the creation or as the universe. And they pursued that line of thinking to its logical end. Okay, so there's always a smearing of this basic truth of the creator-creature distinction. So these are all the religions. They have some differences, of course, but they replace, for the most part, the previous mythological polytheism that rose out of the period of the flood and become the dominant religions. Okay, and now, of course, after that we have, you know, Christianity arise out of the Old Testament promises. We have Islam, which is a distortion, as well as Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormonism, all these distortions of biblical truth. The other thing that rises, though, in this period is Greek philosophy. So we have seven world religions, and we have Greek philosophy. Let's think what they all have in common. While they differ in emphasis, they all have one thing in common, so we want to pay close attention to the one thing that's in common. You can't memorize all the details of all these things. That's why I don't teach it that way. This isn't a class on religions, world religions, and so forth. But we try to get to the bottom line, the denominator of the issue. And although differing in details, these seven religions and philosophy all had one thing in common. They emphasized man as Savior. Oh, yeah, thanks. Man as Savior. Now, that was different. The early pagan religions had gods in the background. Those gods were amplified distortions of the people who had great longevity at the time of the flood and maybe before. But by the 6th century, those gods began to drop back into the background very much. And in their place, man himself arises. Man is going to solve his problems. Man is great. Now, if you want a picture of a man as great, several years ago I had someone give me a bookend. I can't remember who gave me that, but it was called, it's a bookend called The Thinker. Maybe you've seen it. It's a man in deep thought. It's a man relying solely upon his brain. Now, if you take his arm and you lift it up like this, this picture, that's these religions, and that's what philosophy, that's what they're saying. Almost all these religions and philosophy were saying that, and all of them still say that, that I don't need God, I don't need revelation from God, I'm not interested in the Word of God, that I and I alone am sufficient, so don't bug me with that revelation business. Now this is so prevalent, it just comes natural. Okay, most people don't even think that they're doing it. Okay, if you want an example of this, just from modern thought, I was watching a documentary on abortion, and they were interviewing the well-known Harvard professor, Alan Dershowitz. And Dershowitz, he was pro-choice all of his life, and then his wife got pregnant, and at 14 weeks, they took her in to have an amniocentesis. This was back in the 80s. And so he's watching the sonogram, you know, while they stick this needle in there to take some cells and so forth. And one of his friends asked him, after that, what he thought about the abortion issue after he saw the sonogram. And he said, well, there's no question that the baby is a person, that it's alive in the womb. And he said, so you think at this point, well, he changed his position. He moved from being a pro-choicer to a pro-lifer. But then he said this. However, he said, we were planning on having that child. I don't know what I would have thought if we were not planning on having the child. Now that's what we're saying autonomy is. That I decide what is true. I decide what is right. I decide what is life. I decide what is non-life, whatever. Okay, that is autonomy. When we are dictating the terms of what is and is not with this. And that's what all these religions ultimately are all about. They emphasize the unchallengeable proposition that man is ultimate, that man decides, that man is autonomous. Now let's go through a few more things here. Whatever these religions and philosophies are that developed out of the exile period taught, they promoted man, they elevated man to a much more prominent role than the older pagan religions. Man is becoming great. And in that sense, they, that is the seven world religions, mirrored the transfer of political supremacy to the Gentiles and rise of an imperialist spirit of the age. What that means is that as man raised himself in political supremacy, as Nebuchadnezzar did in Daniel 3, so also man raised himself in religious and philosophical supremacy. That is the imperialist spirit of the age. So let's review a little philosophy. Okay, we've talked a little bit about some major world religions. We're just talking about big ideas, not class on world religions. We're saying they appear to be distortions of biblical truth, as Jews went into foreign countries with the Torah. And they took those truths, these pagans did, who are there with their sin natures, they distort the truths from the Torah, and they morph them into those religions that we showed. Now we want to talk about philosophy. Greek philosophy is the intellectual repercussion of the rise of Gentile supremacy at the exile. The supremacy of the human intellect. Now if we go back 200 to 300 years before the golden age of Greece, the golden age of Athens, we come to the golden era of Jerusalem and Hebrew thought. We said Solomon was the finest biblical culture the world has ever seen. That's why they call it, scholars call it, the golden era. It's not just because they had a lot of gold. I mean, they did have a lot of gold. A lot of gold. They had a very stable economy. But they also had tremendous interest in music, botany, science, mathematics, astronomy. Every area of life was dominated by biblical thought forms. That is, starting with the text of the Bible and interpreting reality in terms of it. They built a tremendously biblical culture. That culture of Solomon wasn't generated in a single generation. Let's not think that, okay? It took generations of men reaching well back into the period of the Judges and the conquest and the settlement even, studying and thinking through the Torah and the implications of the Torah to develop that biblical culture. That culture was the period when Israel's wisdom literature flourished. You read it in the Proverbs and the Psalms. A wisdom that we argued back when we were in the golden era in the time of David has some very exciting implications for study of world history. We went through Proverbs 8 to show Lady Wisdom and so forth, and we talked about the fact that what enabled Hebrew thought to get off the ground and really move was the fact that Hebrews had access to revelation that said that there was an underlying wisdom under all of creation that brought it into a unified view, a unified field of knowledge. That all, and that underlying that wisdom itself ultimately is a person. That your environment, my environment, ultimately is an infinite, personal God. And He is the wisdom. And today we want to review that underlying wisdom, that basic premise that ultimately, is we'll see, was borrowed by Greek philosophy so it could get off the ground. We said there were five features of biblical wisdom, so let's review them. Important to remember is, in terms of our doctrine of sanctification, remember you have phases, aims, the dimension, the means, and the enemies of sanctification. Here, in the time of Solomon, when we developed these 5 points, we said what we are really keying in on is the aim of sanctification, which is to learn loyalty to God in every area of life. Now, Christianity is not some religious, you know, part of your life, some compartment over here. And then outside of that, you've got your science, you've got your politics, you've got your economy, and all the ways you think about all those things, and the Bible has nothing to do with that. What this is trying to say, the aim of loyalty is to be loyal in all of those areas, to think God's thoughts after Him, whether it be politics, whether it be science, whether it be astronomy, whatever. Okay, to think God's thoughts after Him and not just buy into whatever the culture is saying, whatever the status quo on the university campus is. Now, we said there were 5 features of biblical wisdom. First of all, biblical wisdom gave unity to all the details of life. Okay, because God created all things out of His creative genius, therefore we would say God is not master of one trade or a specialist of one as we have in our day. And therefore, Solomon and his followers studied and enjoyed every area of life, every corner of creation, not as separate entities divorced from one another, but all as diversities of the one great unity that God had created. That's why Dr. Wybrey said, I got this quote here, in a fourth, no, the, I don't have this quote, let's see if I can go back. I skipped it, it's alright, I've got it here. Don't have it for you though. The interests of the men who surrounded David and Solomon were not confined to politics. Well, they were politicians, no question. They ruled the empire. But, he says their interest was not confined to politics. These men constituted the cultural elite of the nation, and the educational system by which they had been trained prepared its peoples not merely for a professional career. Now watch this. Now think of our educational system. It prepared not merely for a professional career. It would be great if we could even prepare people for that today. Okay? Not merely for a career, but for the enjoyment of life in all of its aspects. For the enjoyment of life in all its aspects, making no distinction between the ethical, social, political, and cultural. Now, yes, you could train in math. You could train in literature, you could train in politics, you could train in science. But the idea was that these weren't compartments. These were just aspects. And you could walk from one room to another room, and there'd be a sense that all the rooms are connected. They're all facets of one unified system. And I think that's one of our problems today is we've grown up in a fragmented culture. We've had this idea that I go to school, I got to find out what I want, I got to do. And what I want to do, and I've trained to be a biologist, I've trained to be a musician, I've trained to run a business, I've trained to be a lawyer, and we kind of think, well, I do. Other people, you know, they can do that other stuff. But I can't do that other stuff. Worst of all, that's how we brainwash it. We brainwash ourselves into thinking that this thing, area, doesn't have anything to do with God. You know, math is math, whether or not God exists. Biology is biology, whether or not God exists. Now, that's the pretended neutrality game. That is the game of the world trying to suppress the knowledge of God, trying to shield themselves from God. Just act like all these things are just there. Now, if we really had a profound idea, it would be that we could walk into any area of life, not as an expert, but we could at least have a sharp discussion about all these areas, and we can know where they fit in the larger frame of life. That's the idea, is that biblical wisdom gives unity to the details of life. What do we call a college when it gets, you know, big? You know, the university. Where's the unity? It's very interesting. If there's no absolute truth, and there's nothing to hold it all together, why do we call it a university? The reason we call it a university today is because it's under one administration. The reason we call it a university today is simply because of that. But that's not the old-fashioned way. The idea of the university originally was that on the university campus, we're seeing the diversity in this one grand unity that God has created. That's where the word comes from. But ask an average college student today where the unity is. You know, everybody's doing ant work. You know, we're all specialty laborers. The biblical wisdom literature in the Old Testament reflects a full-orbed view of thought and life. What we're saying here is the Bible is touches on every area. It's big in its scope. Everything. Now, Job deals, for example, with suffering. Anybody else deal with suffering in here? How do we think about suffering? How do we cope with the suffering that we face in our lives? And we've answered that. We've worked through the faith ritual a number of times. Ecclesiastes deals with philosophical questions on life. Now, that's where we're going to end up today, on the fact that Ecclesiastes was basically written in the 1,000 years before Christ and 500 years before Greek philosophy really got going. And so, how did that impact the thought of people in this world that were outside of Israel? Song of Songs faces sex. Boy, we need that bad. As difficult as it is for a pastor to teach about sex, then we really need to get with the program and get our kids involved in what is true biblical sex very early. Because if you don't get them by 6 or 7 and just start getting the ball rolling in the correct direction, I'm not saying tell the whole story. We're talking about get it going in the right direction. I promise you, by 6 or 7, they'll have already been brought in by their friends, their peers, who have been exposed to it and have given them a false view of sex. And then you're setting up learned behavior patterns. They're setting them up. They're laying them down very, very early in life. And they're going to have problems. I guarantee you, most of the sin problems that you have today stem from when you were a young boy or girl, teenager maybe, in that period. And that's when it started. And you still can't get rid of it today, and that's why. So we've got to get on top of this. You know, it starts very easy. For example, I'll just give you one short example because I don't have a lot of time. You can teach this right out of the flood. It's not that difficult. What did God send to the ark? Two of what? Each kind. A boy and a girl. Now, that's all you have to go into on a very basic level. Just get it started right there, okay? We got boy and a girl. Not two boy lambs. Not two boy alligators. Okay? That doesn't work. You can't repopulate the planet, the animal kingdom, in that manner. So you just start very simply with these stories, and you just build, and you work, and you add, and they're developing, they're laying down a pattern for biblical sex. Now, Song of Songs, of course, gets into the advanced stuff, so hopefully we'll teach that sometime. Psalms and Chronicles, okay, musical expression of praise, you know, the music and the role of music and so forth. Daniel has political strategy, you know, how to rule, and if you go into politics and this country, then you need to know Daniel backwards and forwards. Proverbs deals with attitudes toward work and social life. That's obvious that we need that. See what wisdom did. Okay, see what wisdom did is it didn't go into this dichotomy between, well, you've got the sacred and you've got the secular. And there weren't specialists. Okay, these people were Renaissance people. One of the things this does, it radically transforms your idea of what it means to be an educated person. To be an educated person doesn't mean that you necessarily have 5 or 6 PhDs after your name. You may never even go to college. Some of the finest educated people never went to school. They were self-educated. They read, they thought, they disciplined themselves to study and to learn. Okay? They didn't just put them in front of a TV all the time. TV is passive. You don't learn a lot watching TV. You watch. I challenge you to try to learn a lot watching a movie, watching a video. Even from Answers in Genesis, as great as they are, you will have to spend 3 or 4 times as much energy focusing to learn the material because it comes in a visual format like that. You know, George Washington and these guys, Samuel Adams, they didn't need TV to learn. They didn't need all the lights and buzzers. They did just fine. Okay? They were much more brilliant than we were. If you read The Plymouth Plantation by Bradford, you will find out that the people that formed that first colony, many of them in their meeting, when they met for congregational church, many of the laymen knew Greek and Hebrew and would comment on the text. Now, we're a long way from there. A long way. Okay, so these people read, they thought, they disciplined themselves to study and learn. Now, I'm not saying don't go to college, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that people have made it fine without degrees. Now, let's look at a second characteristic of wisdom. Biblical wisdom applies to all men. Now, what we're saying here is it didn't just have to do with Jews. Jews weren't the only ones who had wisdom in the Old Testament. We're saying that the underlying wisdom of creation was discovered, utilized, and perfected by men of other nations. Let's remind ourselves, when Solomon went to build the temple, did he pick his own guys out of Israel to do it? Or did he go up to the Phoenicians, the Tyrians, and the Sidonians, who were skilled carpenters, who they brought into the empire, who also knew how to build ships? How do you think Solomon got his navy started? He didn't just start from the ground up. We're going to do it from scratch. We're Israel. We're the people of God. Ha, ha, ha. No, they recognized that other men live in God's creation too, and other men have tapped into the resources that God has put there, and they've learned how to use the tools of creation, and they perfected it. We could borrow that. We could import that stuff. Why could they import all that stuff? Because wisdom is universal. Who designed the trees? You know, who made men in God's image? The men who cut the trees. There's a higher order to all of this. Because there's a higher order that's the wisdom that's underneath it all. And that can even touch unbelievers. So Solomon didn't import everything. Of course, later he does over-import. But it's all right, for example, to go to outside of Christian scholarship, you know, if you filter it. We're never able to investigate all the details of the sale. Just think of creationists. We had to do all this work on our own. We can never borrow anything from the university researchers who have all the money, who have all the gadgets, who have all the gizmos, who have all the grant money. See, they're the ones with all the big, expensive machines. I remember we dropped $125,000, the USDA, and we used the machine. The next 4 years that I was there, we used it like twice. Okay, we dropped $125,000 on a machine to do DNA analysis. And we use it twice. Now, that's the kind of money that gets thrown around and the thing just never gets used. Just think how many creationists could use that money and would use that money. So, but nevertheless, we take what comes out of that kind of work and we can take the data and rework it in a biblical frame. So can we bring science in from the secular world? Can we bring music in from a secular world? Yeah. If it's filtered, if you filter it, the problem is if we don't filter, and we bring in elements that are inconsistent with Christianity, then we're in a mess, okay? Because we didn't have to import the whole thing. We should have filtered, and now we've become accommodationists. If you don't filter, you end up accommodating to the culture. You bring in pagan stuff, which is what Solomon later got into. So we want to avoid that. But biblical wisdom is found in all men, because all men inevitably show forth that they are made, indeed, in the image of God, whether they admit it or not. Verbally. So that's our second point. Wisdom is found in all men, even unbelievers. Third point about biblical wisdom. When followed, it brings blessing. When rejected, it brings cursing. Now this is a principle. Paul picks it up in Romans 1. Paul says when a person goes negative volition toward God and suppresses the truth that they know about God, what happens to the mind of the person? It's darkened. it progressively darkens. They begin to suck up pagan thought forms. And the more consistent they get with their pagan thought forms, the more progressively foolish they become. That's what we're seeing in the political community right now. The basis for freedom, which is the Word of God, okay, that resulted in a republic form of government. Okay, yet the very people that formed the concept of the republic back at Plymouth, okay, that brought it here, the Puritans, are one of the most maligned and hated groups in American history class. But we can't have that in the classroom, see, the good stuff that they did. We can't bring God in because we got to be religiously neutral here. You know, what a joke. Anyone who knows their history knows that the freedoms of this country were founded on biblical thought, biblical ideas. They were all built into the idea of a covenant, for crying out loud. We don't sit here and give me this line that the underlying current of our country wasn't Christian. That is baloney. The Puritans brought it. Okay, it wasn't the Hindus who came over in the 1600s. Give me a break. It wasn't the Muslims. So our point here is that biblical ideas in a culture bring blessing. But as we watch, as the biblical ideas get rejected and pagan ideas take their place, what do you think happens in society? Cursing. It's just progressively foolish. The fourth thing, biblical wisdom gives a framework for creativity. It's like this. Back in Genesis 1, God spoke all things into existence. And He called the darkness night, He called the light day. And it goes through this 3 days. God sets up the structure, He gives it a name and so forth. Now, what does He tell Adam to do when Adam's on the scene or in the garden and so forth? He brings the animals to him, and what does He say? Adam, I want you to name. You know, give the creature a name. Call it something. So who started the naming? Well, God started it. He named light and darkness, you know, sky and so forth. Who finishes the naming? Adam does. So Adam gets his framework from God. God tells this is the frame, Adam. Now, I'll bring the little animals to you, and what do you call this? Go ahead, give it a name. I've given you the frame. It's your turn, Adam. I want you to name this creature that I made. Now, that is a tremendous picture of the creative license that God has given man. God thinks enough of you and of me to entrust us with the right to create in a limited area underneath the frame using the tools He's given us. Now, so the idea here is that there is room for human creativity within the form of God's creation that was brought about by God's wisdom. It's when we get out of that form, see, this is the danger. A man is going to name. He's going to categorize. Yes, we're made to do that. But when we get outside of the frame that God has given and we start to do it autonomously, remember this guy? In other words, independent of God's Word, then we begin to create outside of that frame, and that's when we run into problems. Because we're creating a false reality. Categories that don't exist. So that's why in the 70s, the medical community, for example, seriously considered controlling population growth by injecting birth control into the water supply. You know, controlling what neighborhoods can have children, what households can have children, and so forth. All under the purview of, well, this is science. It's not science. So the fourth thing about biblical wisdom is it gave those men in Solomon's time a springboard for creativity. And out of that came all the great literature of the wisdom section of the Old Testament. All the great Levitical choirs. All the great art. All the great mathematics. All that creativity burst forth from the womb of biblical wisdom. The fifth and last point. Biblical wisdom spread throughout the world. What we mean here is that the wisdom that God injected into the borders of Israel did not stay inside the borders of Israel. We already know that Israel sits at the major crossroads of the world, such that businessmen, people who traveled and so forth, would pass through, inevitably, Israel in the ancient world. And obviously pick up biblical ideas, biblical thought, during the time of David and Solomon. But it's also well known that King Solomon had very intimate contacts with Phoenician civilization along the Palestinian coastal area near Tyre. After Solomon, King Ahab later married into Sidonian royalty. Not unexpectedly, Israel's literary movement, okay, now we're talking about what they produced, what kind of writings they produced, their literary movement shows definite signs of intercourse with Phoenicia. Although he dated much of the Old Testament wisdom later than Bible-believing scholars, the famous Johns Hopkins archaeologist W.F. Albright discovered an ideological and literary link between Israel and Phoenicia. Now here's why this is so crucial. Those of you who have gone to college, you've read a little bit of Plato or Aristotle, you've read a little bit about philosophy, do you know, remember, that the probably the first course you ever took, the first thing that was usually said was, we don't know what started this movement. There's not a sign of it in Greek history until 600 BC. And then all of a sudden you have the rise of theoretical thought. Before that it was all pre-theoretical thought, tribal thought, you know. Mothers and fathers taught their children whatever the tribe said, and they grew up and they taught that to their children. That's tribal thought. That's pre-theoretical thought. Not necessarily right or wrong, but that's what it is. But all of a sudden in the 6th century before Christ, we have theoretical thought arise in the form of Greek philosophy. Now, they ask in these classes in the university, where did it come from? Where, the Martians dropping in? Sort of like they seeded Earth with life or something? Here's what Albright said. In a forthcoming book, one that never got published, by the way, in a forthcoming book, I shall deal with the origins of the new ways of thinking which seemed suddenly to appear among the Greeks in the early 6th century B.C. The roots of this movement can be traced in the earlier literature of Israel. We have in Keheleth, Ecclesiastes, some of the raw material on which the earliest Greek philosophers built their metaphysical structures. That is a profound observation. A very powerful observation for the conclusion we'll get to today. Western philosophy may well be rooted in King Solomon. Not Socrates, not Plato, not Aristotle. Why? Why is this? Okay, here's the dilemma. It's not just an academic point. It sounds academic. Theoretical thought, the idea that there's an intelligible universe out there that man can know, okay, to get, and man can know by use of autonomous reason or logic, to get off the ground requires that the universe be an intelligible place, first of all. Somehow Plato knew this. He knew that the universe was a rational place. Now, where did he get the idea that the universe was a rational place? People before him didn't even know if 2 plus 2 for sure equaled 4. What? I'm not saying they didn't do the math, I'm just saying they weren't sure that you could really know that. Now, what we have been studying here with the exile is the fact that ideas went out into the Gentile world via Jews. Hebrew thought patterns from the Old Testament. And they weren't just any ideas, these were God's ideas. Now, what Gentiles did to God's ideas, that's another thing. They developed all these religions and so forth. They developed Greek philosophy. Now, what did we just review about the golden era of Solomon? We said, did he have correspondence with foreign nations? Foreign ministers? Yes. We know he had contact with the king of Tyre. We know they had contact with the queen of Sheba. 1 Kings tells us his wisdom was known universally in the ancient world. Universally! So these ideas were going out. What key idea went out that eventually reached Plato? That there was an underlying wisdom under all of nature that brings a unity. Look at what Frankfurt says. Okay, he's commenting also on the rise of Greek philosophy. He says, the early Greek philosophers proceeded with a preposterous boldness on an entirely unproven assumption. They held that the universe is an intelligible whole. In other words, he says, they presume that a single order underlies the chaos of our perceptions, and furthermore, that we are able to comprehend that order. The question is, where did Plato get that idea? I mean, because nobody has a clue. Before Plato, like I said, they weren't even sure you could get 4 out of 2 and 2. What I'm simply suggesting to you is that the concept of a stable universe, a rational universe, was assumed wholly by Greek philosophy, and they probably got it from the wisdom of Solomon during the Golden Era, later taken out by the Jewish exiles. So what does this tell you about the structure of our civilization? We're studying Gentile civilization. We're studying the kingdoms of Daniel. We're studying Gentile imperialism. What does this tell you about the structure of our civilization? It's rooted in what? If we go back to how we got started, we'd have to say ultimately that Gentile culture got it from Israel. Israel got it from the Bible, God spoke it to Israel. And so what is Gentile culture? It's an aberration of the Word of God. It's a perversion. It appreciates the underlying unity that is there that we must get from the Hebrew God. But it hates the God who gives the unity. See, paganism always steals. It distorts. It's a counterfeit of the real to build an autonomous kingdom of man. That's what Daniel's getting at. Okay, that's what Ezekiel's getting at. That's what the book of Revelation is getting at, is that Gentile kingdoms are aberrations of the one true kingdom and the one true God. Gentile systems are corruptions of biblical wisdom in the areas of politics, economics, okay, in the areas of religion and human thought. They're not originals. Okay, they're distortions of the original. Gentile religions are not original. They're distortions of the Word of God. Okay, that's what we're getting at, and that's what we want to see. All right, next time we're going to get into the doctrinal consequences of the exile. With an autonomous religious and philosophical spirit now dominating the age through Gentiles and their kingdoms, how do we live inside Gentile kingdoms and not become those of those Gentile kingdoms? How do we live there but not reflect the same Gentile patterns of thinking? Now that's the battle. That is where this is where the war is taking place. That's why, just looking ahead here a little bit, Romans chapter 12 verse 2 says, "Be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind." Because this is where the war is being fought. It's being waged in the way you think. I may not turn you on, but the way in which a man thinks, as a man thinketh, so is he. It will direct the way that your life is lived. It will direct the way, the decisions you make and the choices that you make in various stages of your life. And so we got to get this straightened out. Now this raises certain questions about civil disobedience that we're going to deal with under the doctrine of separation. Because that's something that becomes a major, major issue as we see in the book of Daniel. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. How do you live, individual believers, live in a society that is officially pagan, officially autonomous? Okay, before these people were living inside Israel. It's nice. It wasn't officially pagan. It was officially biblical. Now they're living out in a hostile environment. And since by parallel, we also live inside a society that is officially pagan, we want to learn how to live in a hostile environment. Okay? All right, let's close with a word of prayer.